Hey, I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to the Marketplace Tech Source Code. Sometimes we do interviews that are way longer than the 4 minutes we have on the air, but we know you want to hear more of them. So here is a basically unedited version of my conversation with Brad Katsuyama. He's a former trader who's the subject of the 2014 Michael Lewis book, Flash Boys. Katsuyama started studying high-frequency trading even before the 2008 financial crash, and he got so into it, he decided to start his own stock exchange called IEX to hopefully remove some of the unfair trading technologies that he told me are rigging the market. We had a long conversation at the IEX offices near the World Trade Center in New York about how exchanges work and what his company is hoping to change. Here's Brad Katsuyama, the source code. So for those who don't know, you know, walk us all the way back to like how exchanges make money.
Sure. How exchanges make money today or how they used to make money?
Ooh, both.
Okay. Exchanges used to make money by matching buyers and sellers and charging a fee to do that. They also had members. So they were member-owned organizations, and there were membership fees to be part of that exchange. And I think over time what's happened is technology has changed the market pretty dramatically. It's led to the rise of automated trading strategies. And some of those strategies, I think, provide a service to the market by, let's say, an ETF gets created on a basket of 30 underlying stocks. A automated high-frequency trading strategy, if the ETF gets overbought, we'll short the ETF, we'll buy the 30 underlying stocks and, you know, let it settle back to fair value and make money that way. What I say is arbitraging correlated products. There's another brand of high-frequency trading that is solely, I think, looking to detect large buyers and sellers, pension funds and mutual funds, and trade against them in ways many of them don't understand. They're starting to begin to understand those things, and they're purely in a predatory fashion, just you know, taking money out of long-term investors' pockets and putting it in their own. And the challenge is that the exchanges kind of have this role. I like to describe the role as like they're the referees of the market, meaning that there are buyers and sellers. Some will make money, some will lose money. In a way, market's kind of zero sum. And the exchange's job is to just make sure that they're meeting on fair terms, that their investment strategies or their views of a company are going to determine who wins and who loses. The exchanges got in the business of selling data and selling technology, where they now make more money selling high-speed data and technology than they actually do for matching buyers and sellers. And I think that's where you kind of cross the chasm. And it's like the referees in the NFL making more money selling things to one of the teams than from actually refereeing the game. What does that do, you know, to the fairness of the game? What does that say about the game itself? And I think, what does that say about the referees? Meaning, do they necessarily want to ref a fair game, or do they want the people who are buying the stuff they're selling to win more than they lose? Because if that wasn't the case, they'd stop buying the stuff. And you now have a market where 50 to 60% of the volume on any given day, sometimes more if it's a really volatile day, is classified as high-frequency trading. So the majority of the stock market are now machines who really don't even understand the fundamentals of a company, who are just trading based on the reactions of other traders. And I think that's a significant problem. So to get to the source of the issues in the stock market, exactly your question, look at where exchanges make money and look at how that changes their priorities.
To simplify that even further, part of the reason that is it fair to say that part of the reason that 50 to 60% of the trading that happens is high-frequency trading is because exchanges get paid for every trade that gets made?
So exchanges benefit from more trading, but also think about it. The New York Stock Exchange, which is what people see on CNBC, they actually own 5 of the 13 stock exchanges.
Hmm.
If the goal is to match buyers and sellers, you would think having less exchanges would give you a higher probability of matching them, unless your goal is to actually keep investors apart to make room for high-frequency traders to step in between. So NASDAQ owns 3 exchanges. BATS CBOE owns 4. So of the 13 stock exchange licenses active in the United States, 12 of them are owned by three companies, and the only one independently left standing is IEX. So their goal is to actually not match buyers and sellers at the best price for the buyer and seller. It's to actually keep them apart to make room for high-speed traders to step in between to arbitrage them against each other. And I think that it's just totally unnecessary, one. But the second part is I can now sell you five market data feeds because you have to buy data from each of my exchanges. I can sell you five connectivity, cross-connects. I can sell you different microwave services. So when I'm selling technology, you have to buy technology and data from each of my exchanges. So not only am I keeping investors apart, but I'm actually selling the same thing over and over again. And that leads, I think they've created a market that benefits, for the most part, high-speed traders.
Right. So what is IEX doing that's different?
Well, to start, we only have one exchange. but, the reason for that is that, we're backed by long-term investors, mutual funds, pension funds. And at the end of the day, they're the backbone of the stock market. They have a view on companies. They invest over long time horizons. They're exactly the kind of shareholder that a public company wants. They don't want someone who's in and out in milliseconds. They want someone who's going to understand their story, buy the company, and if the stock price is down and they believe in the company, to buy more. And I think that this is the group that's been underserved. As the exchanges shift their focus to high-speed traders, they're shifting their focus away from someone. That's the long-term investors. So we had dealt with them. My prior job was I ran trading at the Royal Bank of Canada. We had discovered this weird relationship between exchanges and high-speed traders, which was not well-documented. And we started to kind of educate these investors about how the stock market was actually working, that the New York Stock Exchange isn't down at Wall and Broad Street. What you see on CNBC, all the trading happens in a data center out in Mahwah, New Jersey. They spend $500 million building this building to basically let high-speed traders put their computers right next to the exchange, matching engine, because the closer you are, the faster you get the signal, and the closer you are, the faster you can respond to that signal by trading. So just think about being right next to the exchange lets me get information and trade thousands of times before the last person in line figures out that same piece of information. They know the horse race is over, and they're betting against people who still think the race is happening. And so the exchange, I think, the big benefit was selling the data, selling the technology, and creating co-location, letting them put their servers close. So when we wanted to build an exchange that benefited the long-term investor, we wanted to do the opposite of co-location. And that's actually pushing people a certain distance away from our exchange. And we did that by creating a speed bump. We took 38.5 miles of coiled cable. We put it in a box and stuck that in between us and everyone who connects to IEX. It creates 350 millionths of a second of a pause. But that pause caused probably one of the biggest controversies in recent memory in the stock market, because high-speed traders were very upset. Some actually didn't care at all, which kind of draws the line between who's doing something productive and who isn't. But the exchanges were very upset about that. When you're selling speed, someone else coming along and pushing a speed bump obviously runs counter to that. But by pausing the market for 350 microseconds, it actually gives information time to disseminate, and it puts investors on equal footing to high-speed traders. Because at the end of the day, IEX just needs to know that, let's say the price is trading, the stock's trading at 10 and it moves down to 9 in the simplest terms. High-speed traders want to sell to people who still think 10's the right price. If a trader has an order on IEX, a Capital Group, an investor on the West Coast, they're so far from New York, they're dozens of milliseconds away. But if their order is now sitting on IEX to buy stock is trading at 10, and the stock price drops to 9, a high-speed trader comes in wanting to sell at 10 to Capital Group, but they have to go around the speed bump. And as they're going around the speed bump, IEX realizes the correct price is 9. We will take Capital Group's order and we'll slide it down to 9. High-speed trader will get there to sell at 10. There's nobody there to trade because we don't think that's the right price. And Capital Group now is available to buy stock at 9. And guess what? What happens with the market is, as the market shifts down, sellers are willing to sell at a lower price. So they could actually end up buying at 10 at some later point. But buying at 10 and then 2 milliseconds later, the price being 9, that's happening like the majority of the time on the largest exchanges. Like immediate buyer's or seller's remorse in milliseconds. Like imagine going to Amazon, buying something, and then like going back on the website and saying, wow, it's now, you know, cheaper than where I just bought it. This is what's happening in the stock market every single day.
Right. On the one hand, it's an easy sell to say, we want to prevent you from making a bad trade.
Yeah.
Right. We want to prevent you from having 2 millisecond buyer's remorse.
Yes.
On the other hand, you are also saying we're going to remove some advantages, and people love an advantage.
Yeah.
When they're trying to make
money.
Like, how hard is this sell? I can see why it was controversial.
Yeah. I mean, what's amazing to us is we are in the middle of this huge debate and fight, and all we're trying to do is remove advantages.
Right.
And people view that as...
Is there like better PR for that though? Because it sounds kind of negative.
Well, it's better than creating a disadvantage for someone, I think.
True.
Removing an advantage. You know, I think from our standpoint, it's if you take the view of the ref seriously, and you want the market to be fair, and I think the perception of fairness is equally important as actual fairness. And I think we have both the perception and, in fact, it's unfair given what exchanges are selling. Trying to create a level playing field, I think, is really important for the long-term health of the stock market. And so I think by saying we understand that there are microseconds of informational advantage that certain people have and are using that to trade against others, trying to neutralize that, I think is really important. And I think that there's a healthy balance. High frequency trading should exist in today's market just given the evolution of technology. Should it be the majority of the volume in the market? I don't think so. Should it be maybe 20 to 30% of the market? That seems a little bit, you know, more sane to me than not. Even Goldman Sachs just had a research piece out talking about volatility and basically saying, listen, there are strategies out there that can change supply and demand in microseconds. And that's not really good for anybody when buyers are canceling and at the same time shorts are piling on in a matter of microseconds or milliseconds. And I think when you think of the volatility of volatility, that's gone up. And I think, this is a market that there have been tremendous, you know, the easiest way to counter what we just said is to say in 20 years, the stock market's gotten cheaper, it's gotten faster, it's more efficient. All of those are true. That's just technology at work in an industry that needed to be automated. Is this a better system than specialists running around on the floor? I think so. Is that efficiency curve flatter than it should be? Absolutely. Right.
So, when you say it's flatter than it should be, you mean it's benefiting fewer people?
It's benefiting fewer people. Yes. Yeah. Of course, trading's faster. Of course, it's cheaper. But, you know, when you look at the distribution of gains from technology, how much of that is accruing to the end user of the market? How much of it is accruing to the public company? And how much of it is being kept by middlemen? It's being largely accrued by middlemen. And so I think that this isn't an argument against technology. It's not an argument against evolution. It's an argument of, I think to say, how is technology being used? And is the greatest benefit accruing to the people that are most important in the stock market? And I think that's ultimately what we're trying to do.
So who, you know, then the point where the rubber hits the road is who's buying it? You know,
right.
Who wants it and kind of what's your business model looking like now?
So one interesting part of being a stock exchange is you have to actually ask the SEC for permission to do that. We have to apply to be a stock exchange. It was a 2-year process for us and it was highly, highly controversial. And when you look at the landscape of who wanted us to get approved, there were long-term investors like Capital Group and T. Rowe Price and Franklin Templeton, et cetera. There were some brokers that wanted us to get approved. Goldman Sachs wrote a positive letter. J.P. Morgan made, positive comments. When you look at who didn't want IEX to get approved, it was all of the stock exchanges and a very narrow group of high-frequency traders. It was like the perfect setup. Pension funds wanted us approved. There were academics writing letters in support of us. We had more positive comment letters on IEX's like supportive than all comment letters in the history of exchanges combined. We had a huge amount of support, but the people against us were very aggressive. NASDAQ threatened to sue the SEC if they approved IEX. So this is kind of a battle between long-term investors, pensions, asset managers, and some brokers against the exchanges and you know, a small group of high-speed traders. There are high-speed traders that like what IEX is doing. If you think about it, if you're making markets, if you're placing passive bids and offers in the market, just looking to capture spread, do you necessarily like the fact that someone has information and they can use that to pick off your buy or sell order? When you place orders in the market, you're creating an option for people to trade against you. There's a lot of market makers who like what IEX has done because we're neutralizing technology that aggressive high-speed traders use to pick off long-term investors, but also market makers. So it's you know, a lot of people would say, is high-frequency trading good or bad? Well, that you can't answer that question because people use technology to do all sorts of things. And to think they're only using it for good is totally naive. And to think it's all bad is totally naive. It's a combination of both.
Right.
And I think IEX has created a solution that's kind of like filtered out some of the bad actors.
And so now the core business, as I understand it, is that you're making your money currently on trades.
Yeah, our data is free. Our technology is free. Nobody really wants to connect, I think, to the other end of a speed bump or pay to do that or pay a lot of money to do that. But so our data and technologies are free and we charge people to trade. So we make money the way, you know, 99% of citizens would expect a stock market to make money. So we probably look more like the traditional exchange than what's kind of happened in recent years.
And then looking down the road, you also want companies to list on IEX?
Yeah, I mean, New York and NASDAQ have had a 45, you know, year duopoly essentially for listings. You pick New York or you pick NASDAQ, and that's a choice that, you know, even back when I was at my old job when I was running trading, companies would ask me, I said, there's no difference. I mean, do you want to ring the bell, you know, in the studio downtown, or do you want to ring it in Times Square? And that's I think, a business that's ripe for disruption. There hasn't been a third option in a very long time. And so we just got approval to do that at the end of last year. What a lot of people don't know is on January 1st, New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ send out bills for about $750 million to all the companies. And if you switch, you don't get any of your money back. So basically, they lock you in for the year. So for us, this is a business that we have a long-term goal of cracking this business, but realize that, you know, on January 2nd, after writing a big check to the exchange, not a lot of people are like, okay, yeah, I want to switch. But, you know, we just hired the former vice chairman of Bank of America, this guy Dan Cummings, to run corporate services. A lot of my time is invested in that business. We brought on Sarah Ferber, who's now our CFO, to kind of, you know, help bolster that business. So it's we have a long-term goal. You know, duopolies don't change overnight. We have a long-term goal of being a third option in that business. And the discussions we've had have been fantastic. It's duopolies get pretty lazy. And I think that, you know, you've seen New York and NASDAQ's, let's say from 2006 to 2016, over a 10-year period, their market share has fallen 40%. The number of listed companies has fallen by around that amount, but their revenues from that business have gone up 30%+. Like, how is that possible? Right. How do you lose relevance, lose clients, and charge whoever's left more? That's like a pure sign of a duopoly, right? There's virtually no price competition. People don't see a big differentiation between the two of them. And I think we see all these signs as opportunities for us.
And so what would you offer? You know, like, what is your pitch to a company? Come pay us your $500,000 a year instead.
Well, first, I think it's way less. The role of a listing exchange has changed dramatically because the market share is like, a company that lists on New York no longer trades 80% of its volume on New York. You know, New York Stock Exchange, you know, in general, I think is about 12.5% market share, the one you see on TV. So I think it's opening and closing the stock. It's surveilling the stock, meaning what's happening in the stock, is there manipulation, et cetera. You know, those are really the primary functions of a listing market and, you know, ensuring that you maintain regulatory standards. We're far more aligned in designing a market with, you know, in the best interests of these companies, because we're designing the best interests of their shareholders, you know, the long term investors that want to own their stock. And I think we've met CEOs who have come to us and said, according to the volume in my stock, my entire shareholder base has turned over 15 times this year, and my top 10 holders are exactly the same. Like, what in the world is happening? So, in many ways, you know, public company stock price has become a distraction. It's harmful to employees. It's they're watching the volatility. They're watching these stocks whip around. The stock's down 5%. No one has any idea. A stock market that has become unhinged from fundamentals is a problem. So the same reason Goldman writes that research report, it's the same questions companies are asking over and over. Most companies don't even know there are 13 stock exchanges, let alone New York owns 5 of them. Most of them don't understand that the business lines have shifted. And so the exact same way we built trust with asset managers, long-term investors, it started not by saying, give me your business. It started by saying, just here's how the stock market works. Here's what we're trying to do to combat that. And we think we're a better partner. And I think that's what we did when I was at RBC. This is what we did when we were at IEX. And this is what we plan to do with corporates, is just start by educating and let, you know, get them, you know, make this an obvious choice. Do you want to align with the high-speed trading community and the exchanges and help them make money by, you know, turning your stock into a casino chip? Or do you want to align with, you know, your long-term investors and your shareholders?
Mm-hmm. So you're trying to create an ecosystem that companies would want to be a part of because it benefits them in the long term. However, I feel like the counterargument to that is the system seems to be working so far, right? Yes, the shareholder base might turn over a lot,
yeah,
but everybody's making money right now.
Well, in up markets, you know, again, I think a bull market kind of solves all ills. Although there are companies that have had, you know, mini flash crashes in their stocks. There are companies that have had buybacks and have watched them kind of get manipulated. And I think that, so, you know, focusing on people who first and foremost have experienced problems and have been unsatisfied with the answers that they've received as to why these problems exist, that's a great starting point. I think, again, it doesn't change overnight. There are some people who, again, this, how high on the priority list is where you list when there've only been two options. There's a dozen switches a year. So this isn't like a hot topic. So, again, that's why we're focused first on educating is to find the people that have had issues, that haven't been satisfied with answers, that don't want their stock price to be a distraction. I think that's kind of a good starting point for us.
Well, and that said, that everybody's making money, there is a growing conversation about short-termism. You know,
right.
Just saw the notes questioning quarterly reports and,
yep,
and, you know, forecasting.
Yeah.
And there's a move afoot in Silicon Valley. Venture capitalists are saying,
yep,
companies should stay private longer, not IPO at all, because patience is yep, a better virtue. And then you have a move towards something called the long-term stock exchange.
Yep.
There's like 9 questions in there, and I'm going to try to pick one,
sure,
at a time. From the perspective of this kind of broader conversation that is starting about short-termism,
yeah,
do you feel like this is just good timing for you? Is this your moment?
I think it's great timing for us. You know, what's interesting is that I was at a conference where asset managers felt that asset owners were viewing them in a too short-term of a fashion. I know that asset managers put a lot of pressures on brokers, but they're talking about, you know, quarters versus years, decades. Talking about long-termism and then carrying short-term, it's kind of a bit of a psychological trick. And I think one of the biggest drivers of that trick is the stock price, right? So a board makes a decision, they announce the decision, and the stock trades up or down. They're immediately evaluating that decision based on what the stock has done the next day, relative to saying, you know, we believe in this strategy. This is just a blip on the radar. So stock market prices being divorced from reality, I think, is a huge psychological driver to force people to think short term. To think that those prices are being determined based on microseconds and milliseconds, and that 50 to 60% of your volume is being traded by people who are holding your stock for milliseconds. It's like getting to the heart of the issue. I think there is a parallel between what's happening, the issues we're dealing with in microseconds and milliseconds, and kind of the psychological impact of that volatility on people making decisions for quarters, years, and decades.
Mm-hmm. But what about the sort of then? What about the private equity question? Like, what if companies? This is in my industry, at least, right?
Right.
In the tech world, this is happening where companies,
yeah,
are saying, we're opting out of the IPO process.
Yeah.
Where we are going to look at alternative ways to take a company public through a large venture capital fund, for example. What is that a long-term, is long-termism a long-term threat to the idea of a public exchange?
Well, I think it's, so it's interesting. I think there's a number of fronts, right? There's the regulatory burden of being public. I think that's one kind of front. There's the accessibility to private capital, which is another front. But then there's also this idea of the volatility of being a public company and the distraction of to employees and seeing things like, you know, Facebook or seeing some of these like initial offerings that have that became a complete distraction. Facebook's a huge success story, but there are many that aren't, that never survived that first drop, and are still trying to, you know, get bail themselves out. And I think that, you know, the psychological impact of that on your company is one that a lot of founders and companies notice. And I think it's, again, it comes back to the idea that the reason we partnered with long-term investors is that they are the backbone of this market. They are the ones who can efficiently and fundamentally are coming to determine price. They care. They have a belief in a company. They understand when it's undervalued or overvalued, but it's there's a fundamental drive behind that. And they're a minority player in today's stock market. And I think that a stock market that is more grounded in fundamentals, they should be the majority player, and then people are kind of acting around the fringes to make the market more efficient or arbitrage, et cetera. They should not be a role player in the stock market and capital formation. They should be the main player. The only issue is that when exchanges got distracted, chased the money, and started to sell high-speed data and technology, they became a minority player in the market, and kind of IEX is the answer to that.
And then what about long-term stock exchange? Is that a future competitor?
Absolutely. You know, what's interesting is the exchanges fought IEX so hard and like just they threatened to sue the SEC. They did all sorts of things to us. Long-term, we've partnered with long-term stock exchange. Their listing standards are now, we're applying to make them available on IEX's market. So they, although they have a goal of being their own independent exchange, we're going to help them launch their exchange. So we're helping launch a competitor. They could down the line be... At the end of the day, this is a market that needs competition. It needs people that are competing on different, you know, playing fields. They are focused on listing standards. We're focused on trading, which made us good early partners. But if they want to trade themselves, we'll support that. But we're both competing to try to make the market better for long-term investors and for companies. So when the decision came of do we help support someone who might compete with us down the line, the answer to that is absolutely. That's in the best interest of this market. I think we'd be hypocrites if we tried to do something otherwise. But it shows you the difference between what we're trying to do and who we try to represent, that we're helping them become an exchange versus what New York, NASDAQ, and the CBOE did to us, is they tried to basically destroy us and lobbied aggressively on capital. They did everything they could to stop us from being an exchange. And thankfully, the SEC still approved us. And I think without the backing of the asset managers, et cetera, I don't know if we would have gotten approved. That's how powerful the lobby force was against us. But
tell me what you're doing with LTSE. What does that partnership look like?
Sure. So the long-term stock exchange has ideas around listing standards to promote long-term thinking for companies. And they could have tried to launch that as their own exchange. That comes with, I think, a fairly heavy lift and burden. And as we've met them, I know Eric Ries, the founder, we're friends. And I think as we started to think more about it, applying their standards to our exchange would be a way to help get their ideas to market as quickly as possible, with a full understanding that they might want to apply and launch their own exchange after the fact. And I think for us, it was a matter of, although we were creating a potential future competitor, it was about what's the right thing to do for the market in general. If our goal is to help long-term investors and companies, their ideas, I think, create a business model that I think could succeed. And so helping them get that to market as partners, I think, was important. And if we end up competing with them down the line, I think the investors and the companies will benefit from that competition.
So what, you know, you've described what NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange are doing and how they go about their business, but what would they say about how they conduct their business and you know, what's their argument against you?
Well, what they say is that anyone the technology and data is available to anyone who wants to purchase it. Anyone can purchase it. Now, is anyone able to purchase it, or is anyone able to use microseconds of an advantage? The answer to that is obviously no, but the idea that they're willing to sell it to you and I if we pool our money and go try to buy a microwave, you know, connection from them, that they're willing to sell it to us. So I think that the idea that this technology is available to anyone, but how many people want to spend tens of millions of dollars on technology and data, right? The way they characterize IEX, I would say, is that this is a problem that doesn't exist, that the things that we're saying are just simply untrue, that, you know, and I think one of the biggest benefits, I think, for me personally, starting IEX, is I live through the problems that we're solving. You can't convince me that what I experienced as a trader, what I've seen from data and working with customers, that these things that are happening to them don't exist. I've lived through it. The one advice when I do talks to, you know, students or, you know, kind of at fintech conferences, budding entrepreneurs, I always say, try to experience the problems that you're setting out to solve, because people are so good at convincing you problems don't exist. You never want to doubt yourself whether you're on a crusade that actually isn't warranted or that might not exist. So if you're, you know, acting on firsthand information is always important. So when I'm responding to them, or whether I'm testifying in front of the Senate or in front of Congress or any of these things, I'm on television talking, I'm doing this interview, I'm speaking from firsthand experience. These things exist. I've seen them with my own eyes. I've studied them. I've seen the data. We have a good understanding of what's happening. So they'll try to minimize it. You know, you're not going to catch them on TV or maybe the odd time, you know, saying something that isn't like technically some form of the truth or some, they're going to just say generically Flash Boys is fiction, or generically IEX is, they're just spin doctoring this. It's just marketing. And I think that, again, look at the list of SEC fines that have come out after Flash Boys. They've basically fined people for the conduct almost to a T that Flash Boys laid out. So we've been validated by regulatory action. We've lived these things. We know they're true, and that gives us a lot of confidence that we're going to win this.
Then, and let's go back to the financial crisis. Let's do our divided decade part of this.
Sure.
There were so many factors that went into the 2008 crash, but fundamentally, you know, we were talking about this earlier. Fundamentally, deception was right at the root of it.
Yeah.
Are you, and is it possible to, you know, you can filter out unfair advantages, you can filter out high frequency trading. Is it possible to build a system that can also prevent against the kind of fraud that greed enables?
Oh, wow. Great question. I mean, one of the motivations for starting IEX was to build a business model based on transparency and trust. The idea that you don't have to deceive clients to make higher margins, or you don't have to create complexity to make more money. Essentially, if you think of the way, you know, the system has generally, you know, existed, it's that, you know, I win. Information asymmetry determines profits. If I have more information than you, 9 times out of 10 in a transactional business, I will walk away with the money. And that gives me two motives. Number one, to increase my edge, I either give you less information, give you wrong information, or hoard information myself. I do think that, you know, the world's changing in a way where as the world gets more transparent, as society gets more transparent, it does increase accountability for companies in general. And I think that that kind of model has a limited shelf life. And, you know, part of this was to say at IEX, can we fuel our mission based on trust? The fact that the asset managers trust us, and this has been a decade-long process for us in building that trust, can we turn that into a business model where we're transparent about how we charge, we're transparent about how we intend to make money, and we make money by educating people about a system that's designed essentially to almost do the opposite. You know, the most opaque businesses are the most profitable. And so I think, you know, trying to set an example in starting IEX was one part of the motivation. You know, our corner of the world we're solving, you know, people say, well, what about fixed income? Or what about this? What about that? There are a lot of problems out there. But I think going back to, you know, the idea of if we can help other people start similar businesses, if we can provide motivation or inspiration for other people to start certain businesses, there's certainly a better relationship that Wall Street can have with Main Street. And I do think that, you know, in our own microcosm of the world, you know, some of our best partners are Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan. These are big institutions, and we've provided them with a platform to align with their customers. So, and so I think that we're probably most proud of that, in the fact that we've in a small way, and hopefully a bigger way going forward, in a much bigger way going forward, we've changed how actors in our ecosystem compete. I think we've influenced, you know, certain you know, parts of regulation. We've changed the discussion, and we plan to do a lot more of that. I think there are more IEXs out there that are going to have a big impact on this market. The only issue is change is – I say this to my team all the time. You know, we're on the right side of this. I know that for a fact. I believe we're going to win. I just don't know when. Timing is the key. How long does it take for things to change? And I think it's a decades long transformation, not a months or years long transformation.
Well, and when you look ahead to what we often describe as the inevitable next crash,
yeah,
is that likely to be caused by the forces that you are trying to combat? And then is that going to be a selling point for you?
So the next crash will inevitably be a selling point for any business that's trying to sell transparency and trust. I think that what's interesting about one dynamic that I've seen is that when the smartest people in the room are just trying to make things more complicated and make it harder for people to understand, it's a very one-sided debate, and that ends up leading to – it fuels greed. It builds up this kind of inevitable bubble that at some point – the experts see it coming and no one else does, and then that leads to this, you know, crisis. In our world, in equities, in equity trading, there are equally sophisticated people now on both sides of the argument. And so any proposal that was made that might have been kind of blindly ushered through because no one opposed it, we can now be a counter voice. There are other people that can be a counter voice. The investors are more educated than ever. It'll be much harder to pull a fast one in equities than it was 10 years ago. And I think the balancing of sophistication is really critical to the system kind of righting itself. And I think that that's how I see this changing. The discussion in general, like an example is the exchanges sell advantages to high-speed traders. Why would anyone send an order there? Why would any like normal long-term investor send an order there? What a lot of people don't know is that the exchanges pay $2.7 billion a year in rebates to brokers to send them orders. If that order is a client's order, the broker, 99 times out of 100, if it's a long-term investor, is keeping it. So the client pays the broker to execute, and the broker gets paid again by the exchange to send it to a certain exchange. When IEX launched, we were the only exchange not to pay rebates. And the challenge is for brokers, if every exchange pays a rebate, what do you do? You can't avoid rebates. It's kind of like it's part of the system. But now that there's a new option, IEX, what do you do about that? So like a JP Morgan or a Goldman Sachs, they view us as a real option. So the SEC now starts to see data that an exchange without rebates has the highest execution quality but still isn't growing very fast. And the exchanges with the longest lines to buy or sell stock are the ones that pay the highest rebate. People are getting the longest line to have the worst outcome. That doesn't make any sense in a competitive environment. It's the rebate. So the SEC issues this proposal. It's happening. It's real time right now, saying we want to test this conflict in the market. There's public data that shows that it's a conflict. And we want to launch a pilot to basically test the elimination of rebates. CalPERS, Ontario Teachers, you know, Capital Group, Vanguard are all saying yes. Goldman Sachs is saying skip the pilot. We know this is an issue. Let's address it like more directly. RBC, so like this particular pilot has so much support, but so much sophisticated support. The exchanges are screaming bloody murder all over again. But now there's a counter argument where both sides are equally informed, and I think the right decision is going to get made. A lot of the regulation that got passed that disadvantaged, you know, the everyday person, they had no voice. There was no one saying, don't do this, or, hey, this is going to end poorly. Now I think there's this balance of opinions. It's still pretty heavily skewed in one direction, but I anticipate over the next few years the conversation becomes more balanced. When that conversation is more balanced, then the person kind of that's not a part of Wall Street, but whose money through a pension or a mutual fund is, you know, running through the systems of Wall Street, can take probably a bit of a sigh of relief that there are experts that are trying to help me as and are fighting as hard as the people who are trying to take money out of my pocket. That's the hope. And I think that was a big motivation for starting IEX. Not that we could solve all of these problems, but that we could kind of start a bit of a movement to say, you know, not everyone who understands the details needs to exploit them. That's really what it is. It's those who find loopholes to exploit just go out and do it for their own profit. And we just took a different approach. And it's amazing to me sometimes how controversial that is. It's just trying to do the right thing. But there's a lot of money being made doing the opposite of the right thing. So I can understand that. Yeah.
Brad Katsuyama is CEO of IEX. Thanks so much for talking with me.
All right. Thank you.
I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.